Mr. President, members of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, ladies and gentlemen, I certainly call it a privilege and an honor to be able to appear here tonight to welcome you to this Washington Centennial celebration. I want to say to you that as soon as I have made my welcoming speech, it'll be necessary for me to go back over to the White House and prepare a half a dozen political speeches, more or less, for future use. I can assure you that this is one of those non-political appearances of the President of the United States. I'm deeply honored at being with you tonight on the 100th anniversary of the founding of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. As President of the United States, I welcome you to Washington. In the 100 years since the association was organized, science has helped transform the United States into the most productive nation in the world. I know that in your meeting this week, you will be looking back over the progress of American science in the past century. I also know that you are much more interested in looking into the future. You're looking forward, I know, because we stand at this moment at the threshold of revolutionary development. In fact, I think we're facing the greatest age in history. Scientific research daily becomes more important to our agriculture, our industry, and our health. Members of this association know better than I what developments to expect in the years ahead in physics, in chemistry, in biology, and in the other sciences. But I'm certain of this, that science will change our lives in the century ahead even more than it has changed them in the 100 years just past. I'm making that as a prophecy, and I'm not in the same class as the Commissioner of Patents, who appeared before the Appropriations Committee of the Senate about 1844 or 45. I discovered this when Dr. Condon's predecessor was down before the Appropriations Committee in the Senate trying to get an appropriation for the Bureau of Standards, and he was having a lot of trouble getting it. This patent commissioner came up with a recommendation to the Senate in 1844-45 that the patent office should be abolished simply because everything that could be invented and patented had been invented and patented, and there wasn't any use continuing the patent office in existence. We have a lot of people like that even today. I don't think you belong in that class. I hope you will also be thinking about the relationship between science and our national policy. 2 years ago, I appointed the Scientific Research Board. Its report, entitled Science and Public Policy, was submitted last fall to the 80th Congress. That report stressed the importance of science to our national welfare, and it contained a number of important regulations, recommendations. The most important were these. Didn't contain any regulations, I'm happy to see, nor any suggestions for regulations. First, we should double our total public and private allocations of funds to the sciences. We are now devoting, through federal and private expenditure, a little more than $1 billion a year for research and development. That sounds like an immense sum. With a national income, however, of more than $200 billion annually, the board felt that we should devote at least $2 billion to scientific research and development for each year. And when you consider that that's a very, very small amount when compared to that $200 billion, I think it ought to be done. Second, greater emphasis should be placed on basic research and on medical research. Third, a national science foundation should be established. I pled to that Congress to give me a National Science Foundation. They offered a National Science Bill, which eliminated the President from the government of the United States, and I wouldn't sign it. Fourth, more aid should be granted to the universities, both for student scholarships and for research facilities. Fifth, the work of the research agencies of the federal government should be better financed and coordinated. I hope that you've been weighing these recommendations carefully, and that if you agree with me that they are sound, you will consider how they can be made effective national policy. I think that's vitally important. I know that you're also deeply concerned with the relationship of science to our national defense and security. 3 years ago, when the fighting stopped, all of us were eager to return to our peacetime pursuits. The first thought of a great many of us was how to translate our wartime advances in scientific knowledge into better standards of living. It is an unfortunate fact, however, that the peace we hope for has not come quickly. We are still living in hazardous times. We are required to give unremitting thought to the defense of the United States at a period when defense has become incredibly more difficult and more expensive. American scientists must, like all the rest of our citizens, devote a part of their strength and skill to keeping the nation strong. At a time when we hope our scientific efforts could be directed almost exclusively to improving the well-being of our people, we must instead make unprecedented peacetime efforts to maintain our military strength. For we have learned, and we have learned the hard and bitter way, that we cannot hope for a lasting peace with justice if we do not remain strong in the cause of peace. I remember Potsdam. They got to discussing that matter in eastern Poland, and it was remarked by the Prime Minister of Great Britain that the Pope would not be happy over that arrangement with that Catholic end of Poland. And the Generalissimo, Prime Minister of Russia, leaned on the table and pulled his mustache like that and looked over at Mr. Churchill and said, "Mr. Churchill, Mr. Prime Minister, how many divisions did you say the Pope had?" If we are to maintain the leadership in science that is essential to national strength, we must vigorously press ahead in research. There's one simple axiom on which this thought is based. The secrets of nature are not our monopoly. Any nation that is willing and able to make the effort can learn the secrets that we have learned. Such a nation may indeed discover new facts of nature we have not yet discovered. Our problem, therefore, is not a static one of preserving what we have. Our problem is to continue to engage in pure or fundamental research in all scientific fields. Such research alone leads to striking developments that mean leadership. Yet it is precisely in this area that we, as a nation, have been weakest. We've been strong in applied science and in technology, but in the past we have relied largely on Europe for basic knowledge. Your research is arduous, demanding, and difficult. It requires unusual intellectual powers. It requires extensive and specialized training. It requires intense concentration. Possibly only when all the faculties of the scientist are brought to bear on a problem with no disturbance or distraction is when he can do his best work. Some of the fundamental research necessary to our national interest is being undertaken by the federal government. The government has, I believe, two obligations in connection with this research if we are to obtain the results we hope for. First, it must provide truly adequate funds and facilities. Second, it must provide the working atmosphere in which research progress is possible. As to the first point, the government is developing impressive programs in many scientific fields. Fundamental research is being carried on for the national military establishment in the laboratories of the armed forces, of industry, and of our universities. The Atomic Energy Commission has been pushing its extensive research. The National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics has expanded its many aeronautical developments. The Federal Security Agency has engaged in extensive medical studies in its own laboratories, like the National Institute for Health, and through grants to colleges and universities. Other federal agencies, such as the Departments of Commerce, of Agriculture, and of the Interior, have pursued vigorous programs. The Interdepartmental Committee on Scientific Research and Development, appointed by me last March, aids in coordinating the government's many research programs. I sincerely hope that these programs will be further developed and coordinated by the early passage of a National Science Foundation bill. The second obligation of the federal government in connection with basic research is to provide working conditions under which scientists will be encouraged to work for the government. Scientists do not want to work in ivory towers, but they do want to work in an atmosphere free from suspicion and personal insult or politically motivated attacks. It is highly unfortunate that we have not been able to maintain the proper conditions for best scientific work. This failure has grave implications for our national security and welfare. Now, there are some politicians, and I could name them, who are under the impression that scientific knowledge belongs only to them. They seem to feel that it is dangerous to let the scientists know anything about scientific developments in this country. Rumors come to me that one of them even made the remark as to why we let the scientists know anything about the atomic bomb. This situation has been of increasing concern to me. It was highlighted by a telegram I received last week from 8 distinguished scientists. These men expressed their alarm at the deterioration of the relations between scientists and the government because of the frequent attacks which have been made on scientists within the ostensible name of security. The telegram points out that the action of certain groups are creating an atmosphere that makes men shun government work, and that the federal government is losing the services of excellent scientists because they have been looked upon from certain quarters as men not to be trusted. The telegram points out that scientists fully appreciate the need for sensible security measures, but scientists, very understandably, are reluctant to work where they are subject to the possibility of smears that may ruin them professionally for life. That telegram was a balanced and sober presentation of a vital problem that concerns every American. Continuous research by our best scientists is the key to American scientific leadership and true national security. This indispensable work may be made impossible by the creation of an atmosphere in which no man feels safe against the public airing of unfounded rumors, gossip, and plain vilification. Such an atmosphere is un-American, the most un-American thing we have to contend with today. It's the climate of a totalitarian country in which the scientists are expected to change their theories to match changes in the police state's propaganda line. I hardly need to remind this association that it is primarily to scientists that we owe the existence of our atomic energy enterprise. It was to the scientists who first saw the possibility. It was the scientists who first saw the possibility of an atomic bomb. It was the scientists who proved the possibility. It was the scientists who first saw the need of security measures and who, on their own initiative, clamped down a tight lid of secrecy on all experiments. It must not be forgotten for a moment, and it certainly must not be obscured by any smear campaign that, but for the scientists, we would have no atomic energy program. We're only in the beginnings of the atomic age. The knowledge that we now have is but a fraction of the knowledge we must get, whether for peaceful uses or for national defense. We must depend on intensive research to acquire the further knowledge we need. We cannot drive scientists into our laboratory, but if we tolerate reckless, unfair attacks, we can certainly drive them out. These are truths that every scientist knows. They are truths that the American people need to understand. Science has no political affiliation. Concern for our national security is nonpartisan. Sober recognition of scientific research as the basis of our future national security should certainly be nonpartisan. All Americans have a solemn obligation to avoid these methods and procedures which are impeding scientific research, whether adopted mistakenly with good intent or advocated in the name of security by men with other axes to grind and red herrings to drag around. My emphasis tonight has been on the physical and biological sciences. These are obviously in the forefront in the terms of our industry and technology. But the social sciences, and the related fields are at least as important in the present stage of human affairs. The physical sciences offer us tangible goods. Biological sciences, tangible cures. The social sciences offer us better ways of organizing our lives. I have high hopes as our knowledge in these fields increases that the social sciences will enable us to escape from those habits and thoughts which have resulted in so much strife and tragedy. I'm sincerely hoping that we'll develop those social sciences and that we'll develop the atomic energy release for the welfare of mankind so that, as I said a while ago, we'll be living in the greatest age the world has ever seen. And I'm sure that's what we're going to do before we get through. Now and in the years ahead, we need more than anything else the honest and uncompromising common sense of science. Science means a method of thought. That method is characterized by open-mindedness, honesty, perseverance, and above all, by an unflinching passion for knowledge and for truth. When more of the people of the world have learned the ways of the thought of the scientist, we shall have better reason to expect lasting peace and a fuller life for all of us. I thank you.